Welcome, everyone. This is episode 9 of the Big COC podcast. We're recording this on Monday, February 25th at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. It's a kind of a gray day here in Toronto, which is par for the course for this winter. Joining me again, I have a great panel. We got some really interesting topics today. Returning for, I don't know, what's this, the fourth or fifth time, is John Jilks. He's an e-health strategist, and in the opera world, he's best known, I think, to people that are following things going on in Toronto and area from his blog called Opera Ramblings, which can be found at operaramblings.wordpress.com. And really, hi, John.
Hi.
Let's get everyone's voices here so people know who's talking. Also returning is Joseph So, who's professor emeritus at Trent University. And he writes widely on opera in journals such as Opera Canada, La Scena Musicale, where he has a blog, and for the British Opera magazine. Hello, Joseph, how are you?
Good. Nice to be here.
Oh, great to have you. And I'm really happy for the first time to be welcoming Paula Citron, who's an arts journalist, broadcaster, and critic. She writes on dance, theater, opera, and classical music. She's senior dance writer for the Globe and Mail, and she's one of the associate editors of Opera Canada magazine, and also writes for Whole Note magazine, which is, if anyone doesn't know, a great source of everything that's going on in the classical and jazz world here in Toronto. It's a free magazine you can pick up just about anywhere. And she has a website, paulacitron.ca, which is a major commentary on Toronto's performing arts scene. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you for asking me.
Oh, you're most welcome. Very excited to have you. And my name is Gianmarco Segato. I'm the Adult Programs Manager here at the Canadian Opera Company. So we have a couple sort of in the news stories today. The first one I want to cover is a story which appeared just last week in the Globe and Mail, the compulsory standing O, as it was called. And I just wanted to read a couple excerpts from it just to give our listeners, you know, some context. So this was written by the drama critic J. Kelly Nestruck. And he starts the article out by saying, "It's time to face the facts. The standing ovation is dead in North America. Yes, the standing O is finito. Theatergoers get up on their feet and clap at the end of plays more than ever, it's true, but that's exactly it. The gesture is no longer exceptional. You'll find people standing and applauding after great performances and less great ones, and sometimes even after lousy ones." So that's how it starts. And there's a few audience comments or reader comments on this article as well, but I thought maybe we'd start with people's observations and reactions to this from who we have here in studio.
You know that it used to be that Toronto never stood. As a matter of fact, we were known as a city that never gave blood. I mean, that's what it was like. And the transformation with people standing now is astonishing. And I'm wondering if it's the influence of the pop world. Because maybe today's audience went to pop concerts in, let's say, the 80s and the 90s, and they are automatically standing. But people have to remember that artists, in a way, always commented that Toronto was very cheap with its standing ovation. And I remember being in audiences and the only one standing and shouting bravo at great performances and being really angry at my fellow audience members. Mm-hmm. So it's been a transformation.
I mean, audience behavior does change. And I don't know, I suppose it makes newspaper articles to write about it, but it doesn't signify much to me. I mean, it's a natural development. They'll come, they'll go. I don't think it's...
But what about this idea that perhaps it's become so indiscriminate, and therefore, I mean, standing ovation traditionally was for something very exceptional, and now if they're standing for anything, then how do you know
that's the point. It's changed. So it no longer signifies an amazing performance. Actually, what I find is interesting is once upon a time, at least in the houses I used to go to, a standing ovation would be more or less universal if it happened at all. It either happened or it didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, what we get at the Four Seasons Center is kind of the sporadic progressive standing ovation where a few people here and there stand and a few more think, hey, I could do that too. But you never see the whole audience on its feet. Yeah. In fact, you'll always see a quarter of the audience scurrying for the exit at high speed, even after a world-shattering performance.
It's very much a North American phenomenon.
Right.
I just came back from Parsifal at the Met, and yes, it was a great performance. So, I mean, it was a deserved standing ovation. But I go to Europe all the time. Every summer I go to Germany, and I actually haven't seen any standing ovations in Munich during the festival.
Because I cover dance as well, and I think the dance audiences are far more discriminating, because you'll see if some people liked it, they will stand. If everybody liked it, everybody will stand. Or often they'll just be applause. So it hasn't, the standing, plague hasn't hit dance yet. And let's you know, be true to the cause. Sometimes you stand because the person in front of you stood and you want to see the curtain call.
Yeah, that's happened to me a lot, where you're kind of sitting thinking, okay, I don't really want to stand, but then the whole row in front of you is standing and you want to see the performers.
Yes.
And I think that's like a ripple effect sometimes. But actually, one of the comments kind of goes back to the first thing you talked about, Paula, about Toronto being a traditionally stingy in the past with their applause. And this person just, who was commenting on the article we're talking about, said, still, in my opinion, in this country, Canada, theater or symphony goers do not offer enough ovations at the end. I come from Europe, and both there and here, I regularly attend theater and symphony performances. And this is the point I thought was kind of interesting. He said, it never ceases to amaze me that here, after a brilliant performance, people clap for approximately 45 seconds, if that, standing or not standing, and then get up and rush to the coat check or to the parking lot.
I wouldn't
I sometimes think
depends on the performance. Mm-hmm. Depends on the medium, you know.
Yeah, right? But Joe, I mean, you've been to Europe, as have I, and in Europe, if they like something, we're talking 15 curtain calls. They won't let those people off the stage.
That is
we
big
do
difference.
Not, if it is, let's say it's a deserved standing ovation and everybody's standing, it still will not be long. We do not have the tradition of having a long standing ovation, not like in Europe where it can go on forever.
Usually the curtain comes down completely and then the singers come out in front. So there's actually two parts to an ovation, to a curtain call. First, you know, in the part of the scenery, and then later, after the curtain comes down, they come out, you know. And I see that a lot. And even if there's 50 people staying behind in the auditorium, in Munich, for example, they will continue to come out to receive the audience accolades.
Yeah.
And
as
I find that very
nice. As long
as the
clapping is going on.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they won't come out and, you know, that's really like a cheap shot if they come out and they make you clap.
That does happen.
But the length is not long. I mean, even like, let's say even at the Met, it doesn't go on and on and on. Maybe the Met has the longest of the standing ovations of the opera houses I've been in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree? I mean,
because one would like to think of the Met audience as quite discerning, you know. Actually, to me, the standing ovation really isn't the one issue that bugs me. One issue related to this that bugs me is people applaud before the music stops.
Oh, yeah.
That annoys the hell out of me.
That drives me crazy.
It happened even in Parsifal, you know, and this act one, supposedly, you know, Wagner didn't want people to applaud after the end of act one. And so, not too many people applauded at the Met, but there was some very persistent, loud applause, as if to make a statement.
Actually, that brings up one thing that does bug me, is when people take curtain calls at the end of an act. I don't know why it bugs me, but it does.
Are you talking about people that we're not going to see again, who are...
Yeah, but they should still wait till the end of the show.
Maybe they wanted to go out for dinner.
No, but they'll appear at the curtain call at the end too.
Yeah.
They always do. I mean, just because you don't appear in Act 3 doesn't mean you shoot off home.
I think sometimes if it's a long night, like for instance in Tristan, I mean, it was just a small role, the sailor, I mean, he doesn't sing again. So he wasn't around it, but he didn't get a curtain call. It's a very short role.
And neither did the chorus.
No, they got let to go. Yeah, they were allowed to go home. It's a long evening if you're not appearing again. And so much of their stuff was off stage, I think, too.
I did read that article, and I would be hesitant to have too many rules about what audience can or cannot do.
All right. But I remember the very first symphony concert I ever went to, and it was Brahms' Academic Overture. And you know it's got that false ending? So I thought it was over, and I started to clap, and I realized I was one of the few. I was so embarrassed. I thought I was going to die, and I learned my lesson that you wait until the music is over. And, I mean, it was a really humiliating lesson for me. I go crazy at a recital when you've got a whole song cycle and people are clapping in between. That drives me crazy. It goes along with what you said. And I think we have to start telling people. Like, maybe at the bottom there's a little note in the prosing, please don't clap, you know, between each section of a piece. Mm-hmm. But you have to read the whole thing before you get there.
And then you may
why don't they put it in big bold letters and announce it? We have to start training the audiences all over
again. I've seen that done at later recitals.
Yes,
it was done at Franz Josef's recital the other week. Nina, you know, announced that the Franz Josef had asked that people hold the applause to the end of the two cycles.
Yeah,
and just I think that's fair enough, because you can't assume that people know.
At one point, we did know.
Yeah, it's changed.
Maybe it's a good thing. I mean, because that implies that there's at least some turnover in the audience.
maybe some of the younger
Well, yeah, this is obviously kind of a sort of separate issue, but I have noticed that. In fact, and the concert that John was just referring to was one of our free concerts at the Richard Bradshaw Amphitheater, just for people who may not be in Toronto. But about a week before that, or just before that, one of our ensemble artists, Cameron McPhail, did Dichterliebe, and they were clapping between each song, which, you know, I mean, it's fine to show appreciation. I think it's great, but it's very difficult for the singer and the pianist.
Go ahead.
Between songs, I guess, yes, it's no good. But there was, in another New Now concert, it was right in the middle of an aria. Somebody applauded.
Yeah. That happened recently.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was totally shocked.
But also it shows, I'm an adult education manager. part of my job, people art kind of job. And I hate to say, you know, educate the masses, but I mean, it's not trying to be elitist. It's just
no, it's not elitist. I mean, it's good manners in the sense that it you don't want people to do things that'll detract from other people's enjoyment.
Right.
That's what basic good manners is. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't assume in a country that no longer has arts education and all the rest of it, that kids are going to grow up going to leader recitals and learn that at an early age. It isn't going to happen. So I don't think it's unfair or wrong or intrusive or elitist that, you know, somebody like Nina in the context of a leader recital, you know, basically directs what's going to happen. Yeah. I think it's fair enough.
But audiences learn quickly. I mean, if you've been at the symphony or at a leader recital, and people start to clap inappropriately, and when they realize they stop. You know, unless it's some, you know, idiot trying to show off, basically speaking, because they're there in the audience. Mm-hmm. But audiences do learn quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think we've covered that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, a very related issue, but actually it deserves another topic other time, is the issue of booing. You were talking about, you know, disturbing other people's enjoyment. Booing, you know, is hopefully a very genuine kind of expression of dislike for performance, but it also disturbs other people who enjoy it, what do you think?
Nowadays, the convention seems to be you never boo a performer, but you boo productions.
Yeah, but if you're booing, how do they know who is being booed?
Well, on opening night, usually the production team comes out at the end.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, it's pretty clear then.
I think that's really offensive. I just
maybe we can talk about that another time.
Yes,
because I think there are differences between North America and Europe, perhaps.
I think the art of booing is lost.
Yeah, it's like now the standing ovation. We've come full circle with all this. Now, it's as I said, it's Monday, February 25th. So that means here at the COC, we've just ended our winter run of operas, and we had Tristan und Isolde. by Wagner and Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito. And what we're finding increasingly, and it's great, our audience is actually engaging with us on Twitter and Facebook, and we get comments about productions and singers, and overwhelmingly positive. But of course, like any artistic enterprise, not everyone's going to love everything. And one thing I'm especially interested in hopefully discussing a bit with everyone here today is, I'm going to call it the issue of pants rolls, because it does seem to be an issue for some people. But obviously in opera, there's this tradition of young male characters being sung by female voices. So we've got characters like Cherubino is the obvious one that we all go to. He's the young page boy in Marriage of Figaro, usually sung by a mezzo-soprano or a soprano. Now, in the production we just closed of Clemenza di Tito, there are two male roles sung by females, Sesto and Anio. In our production, they were both sung by mezzo-sopranos. And what I found interesting in some of the comments we got was some people's, I guess, discomfort in seeing a female dressed as a male interacting with another female on stage, because in this production especially, the female character of Vitellia and the male played by a female character of Sesto were quite physical with each other, but I mean, it didn't go much beyond hugging and some touching. But anyway, I'm just wondering if, I mean, assuming everyone here saw that production.
Yes.
Do you think the way the pants role was portrayed or costumed in this production maybe brought out some of these reactions, or what do you think?
I think that, first of all, it is lack of knowledge. Most of these roles in Handel and the Mozart opera series were done by castrati. Now, we don't do that anymore. You know, unless there's something going on in the Vatican, I don't know. But we do not do that anymore. Therefore, your only recourse is a male countertenor or a male soprano or a young woman doing the role.
In fact, Anio was a mezzo from the get-go. I
mean, yeah, some of them are.
Right, yeah.
So it's quite common to have a mix of, you know, a role that was a castrato role and a role that was a young man played by a female singer. In fact, it's a very interesting example of this in the opera in concert Orlando, which is originally an alto castrato and a mezzo, where they actually use two countertenors.
That's right.
Although I have to say, it's not always hard and fast that necessarily is a pants role, because I've seen Idamante in Domineo sung by a tenor.
There was a Mozart version. I think, you know, that was actually sanctioned by Mozart for after the premiere.
Ah, okay. I actually saw it sung by Gordon Geertz in Santa Fe back in the late 90s. And, I hope whoever objected to it isn't going to buy a ticket to go to see Rosenkavalier.
That was meant to be two women, absolutely. Really.
But I mean, the main thing here is they're actors. They're playing roles in a piece of fiction on stage. I mean, man, woman. I mean, you know, in Shakespeare's time, the women were played by boys.
Absolutely.
And nobody got, you know, as far as I know, nobody got worked up about the fact that, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth might get a bit friendly.
And there was a real furor when it changed in the time of Charles II,
yeah,
and women were allowed
women.
On stage, and people had trouble coping with the fact women playing women's roles.
So you've got this, it's not real anyway factor. And then second, I think if you really have a problem with two women having a hug on stage, then you really need to be looking at yourself rather than what's happening on stage.
I'm trying to figure it out, because I mean, I'm thinking two seasons ago, or you know, it was that recently, Lawrence Zazzo singing, you know, with this high sort of countertenor voice, which, you know, some people associate with female sound playing, but he was playing a male role on stage, and nobody, you know, I mean, and they shouldn't, but nobody had anything to say about that.
A male role was often sung by a woman.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I just wondered, in this production, I think it had something to do with the costuming, perhaps, that they looked a bit gender neutral. And I wondered if that was...
You're talking about Tito.
Yeah, Clemente di Tito.
Especially when you have someone as beautiful as Isabel Lennart.
Yeah.
It kind
or
of...
Wallace.
You
what
know.
Cheekbones. Oh, my God. She's she really is.
Yeah.
But the director made her look really, pardon the expression, butch.
I thought so.
That she was really sort of choreographed in that way, and she did it splendidly. So maybe people were objecting because she was so overtly, deliberately male. Maybe that's what got them. Because in the Handel operas, for example, the only roles that were sung by women were women dressed as men in disguise, but you knew they were women, but they were playing men so that they could get to their beloved or whatever.
That's true of Madoro in Orlando, for example.
Okay, but basically speaking...
There's a lot of them, yeah.
The female...
Oh, and Shakespeare too, right?
Yeah, the female roles were women really in disguise as men, and the rest were done by castrati.
Awesome. So I mean... Basically, there's all kinds of weird gender bending going on. You know, women playing men dressed as women, and men, you know, the whole gamut. And it, you know, I don't know. It's just.
But people, I don't think object in Handel.
I don't think they object in Mozart typically either. I mean, we've all seen productions of Marriage of Figaro where Cherubino is getting physical with every woman he can get his or her paws on.
It's a comedy. I think it might be a difference because it's a comedy.
Once I had a chat with the American countertenor, the one who has sung for opera Terry Lee several times, Maniacci.
Yeah, he calls himself a male soprano.
Yes, he said that he actually contemplated doing Cherubino, and there was even some talk about Octavian, but I think he backed away from it.
Well, it's interesting you should bring his name up, because I'm pretty sure that when Opera Tellier, which is the... one of the other opera companies here in Toronto, did Clemenza di Tito a couple seasons ago. He played Sesto.
That's right.
Yes,
he did. That's right.
He did.
So, and I know at the time the artistic director of the company, Marshall Pankowski, sort of said, well, one of the reasons we chose a male soprano to play this role is because to him it was more believable. You've actually got a gendered male person playing this male character. I don't know. I didn't see that production, so I don't know.
Don't know
if it worked any better.
It did for me.
Yeah.
It was very enjoyable.
But do you feel like it works better than having a female mezzo?
No, I focus on the music, first of all.
Yeah.
And it doesn't bother me who's singing what, as long as they can do justice to the role.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't think that people would have objected 10 years ago. That's why I was surprised to hear about this. I mean, happening now?
Something to talk about, I think.
No, seriously, because I don't... Maybe opera goers were, I don't know, more discerning, and now that it's sort of been working actively to open it up to a larger audience and make it a less elite, the kind of people that you're coming in, the very people you want, have to get used to things. But I don't think that that would have been a problem 10 years ago. I mean, does anybody disagree with me? I really don't think it was. I think you've opened it up to a large audience, which is wonderful, bringing all these new people in, the more the merrier, you know, because we want that demographic to change. But coming with it is also some, you know, conventions that they're going to have to get used to.
So
do we have any idea where this discomfort is coming from in terms of, I mean, is it the younger end of the audience? That would seem incredible to me.
No, it can't be the end.
Probably not. Yeah. Most of the comps, I think, it's hard to say, you know, really. You don't always know who people are.
I have it in my head that it's the same people who, you know, protest bitterly every time that the La Boheme they've seen for 50 years changes.
could be.
I don't know whether it is or not. You know,
Well, I'm going back to something that you said about it being the production. I mean, the director of this particular Tito was Christopher Alden, who was known for his very radical productions. So maybe it's stemming in part from a production whose symbolism maybe was lost on people, you know. Mm-hmm. It was not traditional opera, and maybe that put them off. Like, the more radical the production, the more radical the vision, the more difficult. Let's say if it were a straight, you know, set in Rome, I guess, mm-hmm. and it was done with pillars and columns to represent the Roman Forum, and
the Pinel production,
and nothing, yeah, and nothing unusual happened, I think it would have maybe been more acceptable.
I agree with that. In fact, it leads me to just one last point on this. I was looking at a couple of videos over the weekend just of some of these more traditional productions, and there was a video on actually one of the people that's been on the panel before, Lydia Perovich's blog, and it was just an excerpt of, I think, Anne-Sophie von Otter, but as Idamante in Idomeneo, in a very traditional Met production. And then there was also a clip of Frederica von Stade as, I can't remember, it was Idamante or Sesto now. But anyway, one of these pants roles, but the look that each of these people, these singers had, was sort of big billowy sleeves, leather kind of doublet, and it really disguised their femininity completely. And I think they'd even darken their skin to make them look a bit swarthy. And I could see how in that context, you wouldn't even be thinking that it was a female almost, other than the voice. So I think, yeah, that's maybe part of the reason why there was a bit more consternation this time.
Where in this production of Tito that Christopher Alden did, the Sesto was, not only was she a beautiful woman, but she was wearing a very skimpy little tunic, mm-hmm. and her legs were totally mm-hmm. exposed, and her arms were totally exposed. There was no disguising the fact that she was mm-hmm. a man. She was clearly a woman in that little tunic.
Which is kind of puts an interesting spin on the fact that, because the other bit of gender bending that was going on in Tito was obviously something going on between Tito and Sesto. So you've got this very feminine Sesto kind of in this implied homoerotic relationship with the older man Tito. And so, yeah, so it goes around in all kinds of weird mm-hmm. circles. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I just, our other production this fall, this winter, the Tristan und Isolde, and there were some comments about the kiss between King Mark
yeah.
and Tristan, once King Mark has realized that Tristan has betrayed him by falling in love with Isolde. And there were, you know, I mean, we're talking about a minority point of view here, but again, it's just interesting. It was pointed out, like, well, they could never have been, you know, lovers. And
but that is coming not from the new audience, that is coming from the old audience,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who want their Tristan and Isoldes to look like they've looked like for 50 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And nothing, any change, any different concept is going to really throw them. There's nothing worse than an opera purist, nothing.
You heard it here, folks.
Well, I mean, is anybody going to, you
I'm
know,
gonna disagree?
Well, I think the kiss is introduced as something that, you know, is not in the, it's just an interpretation that
I had never encountered.
Yeah. And now I have seen a production where there's more of a relationship between Corvinal and Tristan. You know, mm-hmm. I think that makes a bit more sense to me. And I went to the Singers Round Table at Arts and Letters Club, and Franz Josef Selig said that he had a long discussion with Peter Sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And Franz Josef said that, as far as I'm concerned, there's absolutely nothing homosexual or anything in this, but rather it is a brotherly or fatherly kind of a mm-hmm. relationship. You know, it's a very deep kind of a brotherly, fatherly love.
I have to say, when I saw the production, it didn't occur to me that he was trying to imply that they were lovers at all.
It was more like this man has been incredibly betrayed,
mm-hmm. and they have a very close relationship. So, to me, it just maybe speaks to some people's discomfort of, in both of these situations, of seeing two men in a physical yeah. relationship on stage and two women.
Totally.
But anyway, everyone has their opinions on this, and it certainly makes for interesting discussion, and I think it proves definitely that opera is not moribund. So, on to the next topic.
That's for sure.
So I thought we'd just kind of end today with a feature we've had the last few episodes on our favorite recordings that we've been listening to, or any live streams we've been watching, or a DVD we've been really excited about, or even just a little YouTube clip. So does anyone have anything they've been obsessed with the last month?
I saw a video, we do stream because it was opening night at Madrid Teatro Real, of a new Philip Glass opera called The Perfect American.
Oh,
do you know
right,
who
Disney.
The Perfect American is?
Yeah, Walt Disney.
Walt Disney. And it's very fascinating. And it's the last year of Walt Disney's life. And it's, you know, I think it explores, you know, modern opera in a very different way, you know, human. I love it. I mean, I have to say, I've been going to opera for 45 years. And when, in the beginning, I think I was probably very green, very conservative. But as time went by, I became more and more accepting, I guess, maybe that's one word of putting it, or understanding of rethinking or reimagining of traditional works. Mm-hmm. And I feel now I'm much more comfortable with it than I used to be, even mm-hmm. like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's Jerry Springer, the opera. I really like comedy but ironic, wry, droll. That's my favorite kind of thing. And I just did an article on the Canadian composer John Weinzweig for Hold On Magazine, because it's a centenary of his birth. And in the research, I came across a Bravo fact, just a 5-minute little Bravo fact that I remember loving when it was first done. And it's called Il Menu, M-E-N-U with an accent grave. And it with Misha Brugger-Gossman, and I forget who the other soprano is, isn't that awful? But John Weinzweig is conducting, and the whole, and he wrote the lyrics and the music, and it's Puccini ravioli, and like a mix of composers' names with vegetables and pasta dishes. And the two sopranos are eating away. It's set in a restaurant, and John Weinzweig is in the clip. He's actually conducting, but as he moves along, he starts to conduct with zucchinis and carrots and other things. And I was laughing so hard, tears were running down my eyes. It was so funny. You know, it was just hilarious. And the other one that I really love is Toothpaste.
Yeah, I've seen
Alexander Louis, Alexander Louis' one with, and it's just, you know, the whole thing about, did you squeeze the toothpaste from the middle or not? And it's a relationship that breaks apart a marriage over this toothpaste. So I love it when people get clever with opera. I really do, because opera can be very serious and over serious and over intense.
I think, yeah, and more comic works, the better. Now, were these on YouTube? Can people catch
yes,
them?
Yes, I know that people can certainly catch the Il Menu one. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And toothpaste has to be there because it got such a real prominent one. But I have to say that I love Jerry Springer, the opera. I really loved it. You know, swear words notwithstanding. When you see an opera chorus standing there, you know, using the famous four-letter words, I thought, yes, you know, opera's arrived in the golden age of exploration.
Right. John?
Oh, well, quick change of mood here. the thing that's really caught my eye in here this month was a DVD of Handel's Theodora from Salzburg Festival. And it's about as far away from Jerry Springer the opera you can get, I think. And one of the things that's interesting about it, of course, is that for so long, there's only been one video recording of Theodora, and it's an absolutely iconic one, the production that Peter Sellers did at Glyndebourne in the 1990s, and it's fantastic, and I thought that nothing could ever replace it. This one doesn't replace it, but it's pretty damn good. It's a Christoph Loy production. It focuses much more on the relationships and less on the sort of religious politics of the piece that Sellers brings out. It's got some fantastic performances in it. Christine Schaefer in the title role is fantastic. Benjamin Mater sings Didymus, and he's gorgeous. I mean, that guy can just nail Handel. Mm-hmm. The production's well worth a look. yeah, you don't get Lorraine Hunt's Irene, but nothing's ever going to replace Lorraine Hunt's Irene. Mm-hmm. But finally, another Theodora that's fit to stand alongside the Sellers, and what's more, it's available on Blu-ray and modern DVD and not 1990s TV quality, so it's that's at least going for it. I was very impressed.
I can't remember, is Theodora an oratorio originally? Or was it an opera? Or is it one of these?
It was one of those things that he wrote so that he could perform it at Covent Garden.
Right, okay. So it's like Semele, it's like Hercules in that way.
But it's essentially operatic in its nature. I mean, you don't have to do anything fancy to make it into an opera. It's not like that. You don't have to do the sort of thing that Klaus Guth did with Messiah. I don't know if you've seen that version, the Messiah that he did at the Theater an der Wien. Fascinating, but...
It really is an oratorio. And more they seem to be trying to stage Messiah and things like this.
And it makes for interesting.
Ian Oh did it.
Or Berlioz.
Right.
Things that were meant to be symphonic.
Yeah.
Oh, my Damnation of Faust.
It's interesting.
That's an interesting topic in itself, you know, adapting non-operatic music as stage performance. Well, this coming Friday, of course, you can go and watch two performances of stage song cycles at the Connection Room?
This is Against the Grain Theatre.
Yes. Yeah, they're doing Kurtak Janáček fragments, the Kurtak Kafka fragments and the Janáček song cycle, fully staged.
But that's what that company does. That's their whole mandate, and they're wonderful. I love
great.
Them.
Yeah.
Seen all their productions.
Me too. Terrific.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today for these slightly, I don't know, controversial, I guess you could say, topics. we managed to keep our, you know, nice demeanors here. And that's another episode of the Big COC Podcast. You can catch us on the website. You can go directly to COC Radio and listen to it there. You can also download the MP3 from the website, and also iTunes as well. And we're always open to feedback and comments and questions, and please send them our way via Facebook. We always post the new episodes on Facebook when they appear, and John's been good enough to announce them on his blog as well, so lots of opportunities. And thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
Great.